Welcome to the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. Really excited. Knut Svanholm and Giacomo Zucco, thanks so much for your time, guys, for coming on my show. And let's get it rolling. How are you guys doing? Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Doing good.
Fine, all considering, all things considering.
Considering all the circumstances. Yeah. Okay, let me just put the link on Twitter so people can follow that, and we're ready to go. Okay, now let me start off by saying that I want to start off with this coronavirus COVID-19 thing. Can I ask you, without being crucified as a conspiracy theorist, how credible is this? Is the testing procedure for COVID-19? I mean, because I haven't really found an expert who could explain to me what is really in detail, like the procedure. What is the procedure of the COVID-19? Because I wouldn't be surprised if I had sort of a mild or severe flu, that the test would still show positive.
Well, so I don't know, Knut, if you have more insight into this. I will. I can start because I don't know very much. Most of the criticism most of the critical sense I decided to use in this situation was based mostly on logic and basic statistics and not in deep knowledge about this testing. What I know, which may not be correct, so don't assume I'm correct about this. The idea that I got about testing is that there are at least two main templates. The first one was actually from China, and it was one with a severe false positive tendency. So it could be a little bit like you say, that it could like overestimate a positive case. While the second kind, which is mostly used by nation states right now that I know of, is the German kind from Berlin, is still a reverse polymerase chain reaction. So basically, you take the idea is that you take the protein, and from the protein and amino acid, you go back to the original RNA chain, and so you can isolate some genes that recognize the virus. And in theory, I'm not an expert on that, but you could, I think, if I'm assuming if they are not completely retarded, they are insulating some proteins that can get back to some RNA chain, a fragment of chain, which is typical of the novel coronavirus virus, and so probably not reacting to other kinds. So I would expect a false positive rate, not very, very high. What I know is that this new test has a false negative rate. So sometimes you test one guy once, twice, three times, and he's negative, and then the third time he is positive. And of course, you also don't count all the people that you are not testing, and you don't have to be an expert on testing to understand that if you test everybody around the world, you get maybe, I don't know, let's say a mortality of 1%. If you test people only inside hospitals, then you will have no asymptomatics, because asymptomatics don't go to hospitals, and you will have a death rate of 2%. And if you test everybody inside the ICU, intensive care, then you will probably have mortality of 20%. And then if you test the people inside the morgue, then you will have mortality of 100%. So the problem of testing is not really the test itself, but where it gets done. And for example, in Italy, it's mostly done only inside hospitals. And so the problem is that, of course, the selection bias becomes huge. But in theory, to answer your question directly, I think that the current test is basically like 70% of accuracy. So it should underestimate the positivity. Of course, it also underestimates because it's based on a protein present in the blood. So if you already fought off and won against the virus, you had it, but you don't have the positivity to that because you don't have the protein around anymore. So in that case, you need actually a check on the antigen, basically the antibodies, which is a completely different test, that very few people are doing right now. And that would also be useful in order to understand, especially, I mean, I I'm not an expert, but if I was to gun to my head to decide what to do to test, I would say blood donors with old blood frozen with different age of donors, like in January, in December, in November, and I will test antibodies in those bags of blood, so we could understand exactly where the virus was and where it went and how long was it around. Because I am completely unconvinced about another bias. One bias I told you about is the selection bias of the severity of symptoms. So the more you move towards the morgue, the more severe the symptoms will be. But the other selection bias is, for example, there was this guy in Italy that was considered the patient zero because his wife told somebody that he was in contact with a guy from Wuhan. But then this story was proven false. So this guy was tested and he was positive, but he was assumed to be the first guy spreading the contagion. So everybody was tested only if they were in contact with this guy. And so they built a beautiful chain of spreading, which was based, was just confirming a priori assumption about that guy being the first one. So I don't think the problem is really, I hope the problem is not really that this test is just randomly testing generic coronavirus. I hope that this test is testing this novel coronavirus, but I don't have the competence to confirm you that.
Okay, and another question. Do you think, because there came reports out that, when we listen to the mainstream news now, the narrative has changed. Sort of, it's not that people have died from, I don't know what's the formulation. It's like they express it differently. Say like, testing or after the testing, people have died. So I don't know how many, like how much statistical error and errors intentionally or negligently, like they put people into comorbidity statistics. So they haven't actually died from the virus, but or caused by the virus.
Sorry, but, Knut, I'm talking too much. I will leave you to talk, Knut. But anyway,
no
the point the point here is that there is this kind of underestimation of overestimation of people died for this virus, because everybody positive that was dead for any kind of reason, including terminal stage cancer, was included initially in the statistics. I remember in Worldometer statistic, there was a moment in which a quarantine center in China collapsed, killing in the structural building collapse. It killed like 7 people, all positive, and so the number went up to 7. So initially it was like this. I think that now it's even worse because it's dishomogeneous. Some countries are trying to limit the number to the number which are clinically but it's also, I mean, it's very difficult to decide because. Maybe you are terminally ill, but you will not die now. You will die in 3 months if you don't have that, and that can deteriorate. So it's a slippery slope. I don't think that this kind of underestimation is that important. It's true that most of these people is not dying for coronavirus, but is dying with the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. But it's also true that many people dying for coronavirus are not recorded because they are not tested. So I think we have probably an overestimation because of that and an underestimation because of the untested people. I think that globally, the number of people dead for this could not be so off and so different from that.
Okay.
No, I think we're talking like 5-10%. Mm-hmm. Margin there, something like that. I agree with everything Giacomo said. What I know about the tests for after you've had the disease, like the antigen tests, or what did you call them, Giacomo?
Antibodies. Yeah.
Yeah. That they are more unreliable than the actual when you have the disease tests, and for this reason, our equivalent of the NHS in Sweden are. They aren't testing very many subjects. And I think that's the funny thing about you and me hooking up here talking about Corona, Guillermo, is that we come from opposite countries when it comes to how we tackle Corona, right? And you have a severe crisis. We have a light crisis, or like we're in the first phases of this thing, and you're in like one of the worst places to be in right now when it comes to Corona, right? Even though the US has passed you. But I think what our government has done, we're a close case in Europe, in the sense that we still have quite laissez-faire rules. And I don't think that this is due to like an urge for liberty or like competence on behalf of the government, but it's more like pure luck and a lack of a will to act. We have a lazy government that doesn't act on stuff. Right now, I'm happy to be in Sweden because of exactly this, because I don't like being governed, as you all know. And I think since Sweden is such a country, we have like most single households in the world. Like, people don't live with their families because they depend on the state too much. So we all live lonely up in the north. We stand like 20 meters from each other in the queue to the bus, and we don't sit next to each other in public transportation if we can avoid it. We don't talk to each other that much. I mean, Italy is the total opposite, where you even talk with your hands, right? And you're around, your market squares are filled with people normally every day, and we're like the opposite of that. So for us, it's like basically back to what we were when we were sort of in the East Bloc more than the West Bloc, if you know what I mean. I remember it sort of reminds me of my childhood, this thing, when with a less liberalized Sweden, or whatever you may call it. But I think it's very fascinating that our socialist leaning government is one of the more, you know, allowing governments in Europe right now. And even our closest neighbors, Denmark and Norway, they've taken very draconic measures on this, and they're locking down their countries totally. And I think they have they're more unified in a way. But in Sweden, I think we tend to trust institutions and governments to a very large degree. So if they say that we recommend that you do this and this, we recommend that you stay home, people will do that. Not because of a threat of violence, but because we're very, how shall I put it, prone to follow orders or follow recommendations. We all listen to the government too much, I believe, but this is the outcome right now, and I'm kind of happy with it, since it doesn't clip my wings too much.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I'm not completely bought on the sold, sorry, on the idea of a different timing, because I think that's a current narrative, but I'm not 100% sure that's true about the virus arriving here before and then there. I mean, we don't know, because people looking at number right now, they are looking at number of tests. If you plot the number of positive cases and dead people against the number of tests, basically you see that the numbers are following the tests. And when you have plateau, most of the time is because that the number of tests per day is at plateau. So I'm a little bit skeptical about the timing definition, but that's the actual narrative. But everybody has, you're right, Knut, where we are in the places which are the opposite. Like Sweden is the only place in Europe basically where the lockdown is not really enforced, but just like proposed. And Italy is the place in Europe with the worst kind of lockdown regulation, because right here, unlike in France, you cannot go alone with a mask in a park. You cannot bring your child in a stroller with a mask alone. You cannot do basically anything, unless very stupid things like stay in a row for the supermarket with 100 other people. That you can. Or go to smoke, to buy. So there was a guy that was basically criminally charged 2 days ago, or 3 days ago, because he went to buy food at the supermarket, and he bought one bag of pasta and 3 bottles of wine. And so the cop decided that it was too much wine versus pasta ration, so he was criminally charged. because it was non-essential expense.
That's really. This is what Italy has boiled down to in the 20.
It's incredible, right? And but another thing which is very interesting is that you will say they are more in a way they are less tyrannical because the population is more obedient, so you need less tyranny, which is very interesting because in Italy everybody is very very statist, but they are not very very obedient. So Italy, there is like a double approach to the state. The state is publicly always the friend, so if I have to speak, the state is always good. We have to trust the state. We have to obey the state. And if you don't, I will denounce you because you should. But then privately, everybody is in complete distrust
of the state. So there is opposite here. It's the literal opposite here, because we're allowed. Everybody talks shit about the government all the time in the workplaces, but when push comes to shove, we're obedient. And I don't know what is more frightening, really, when confronted with it like this. Like, I think our system is also corrupt, but people don't see the corruption the same way. And maybe it's a bit less corrupt than Italy, but it's still not a system I trust. And I would like, and there are some limits to what you can say and what you can think that are really scary. Like there are some areas where you just don't go in public conversation here, which is like there was a Brit that once said about Swedes that it's not that they don't change their minds. It's just that they do it all at the same time, like a school of fish. So with the immigration, for instance, we had that, the large numbers in 2015, and all of a sudden when the biggest party, the Social Democrats, thought it was okay to say that, talk about numbers, it was okay to talk about numbers, and then the school of fish went the other way. And so I don't really want to know what to think about it, and I don't know what is scary, what the scariest scenario is here. I find it really disturbing that we're so obedient, but then on a personal level I like not having laws governing me, but recommendations instead.
It's an interesting trade-off. Probably the other, I mean, if you plot everything on a square, I mean, we have like, we are the opposite, and the other opposite may be like Texas and China, because in Texas, they talk shit about the government and they don't obey the government. They should, if I must. And in China, they don't talk shit about the government because they're very nationalistic. And also they
Or Cuba. I went to Cuba. I saw in a kindergarten, there was a picture of Che and Fidel with machine guns, with Kalashnikovs, and it said "Socialismo o muerte" on the mural there to a kindergarten. So, of course, we should plot the countries on a square, like for obedience and.
Nice.
Also,
it's very funny, like socialismo o muerte, like it's an opposition, but actually you usually
socialismo y muerte. That's the correct phrase. Yeah.
Now let me show you this picture. I mean, for the podcast people, it's just hilarious. Can you see this? I guess I assume it's in Germany because it's in German. I don't think it's in Austria. It says together against the virus, reduce the contacts, keep a distance and obey the orders. And you see like, you know, a bench, sort of a, you know, what do you call it? Like a bench, you know, like a metal bench where two people can sit and it's fenced around. And I mean, how ludicrous has this become? How ludicrous has the draconian measures become?
I think the virus is actually bigger than the holes in the fence, right? So it can get through.
So let's talk. Let me tie this in with the questions, because it's pretty good questions by Victor Aram. He asks, he's got a two-part question. He says, great, looking forward. A question to Giacomo. We've seen you denounce the many police state surveillance tools which states are introducing to supposedly fight COVID-19. But what do we really need to fear the state as much as in the past? Let's stick to the first part.
Well, I think they are connected because he says the massive economic meltdowns currently underway is a sign of the end of the fiat system, and thus the clear indication of the rapidly waning powers of the national state. You disagree? So I think it's all one. And this is another very interesting subtle question. So this tonight is a very difficult podcast because usually I have to speak against statism, and some statists will speak in favor of statism. And I would be right, and he would be wrong. So it's easy. Tonight we are being very nuanced about that, like previously Knut about obedience, like exterior or interior obedience. And this is another case. So I think that the answer is not. I would disagree with him partially. I understand what he means, but the point is that when you're when you are confronted with some kind of feral animal, some kind of aggressive animal. Or a bandit like trying to rob you in the street. It's not true that if he is dying or if he is losing power, he will be less dangerous and less scary. Actually, very often it's the other way around, because when you are facing extinction, you do things that you can use a level of aggressions that were unimaginable before for many reasons. Like, for example, if you face an existential threat, then you will start to go beyond any kind of ethical barrier, not the nation state have any kind of ethical barrier, but even consensus barrier. Like even in China, where you don't have election, you still need support, general support from the population. You still need populist support, if not popular support. And when you're facing extinction, you can do stuff that goes beyond that. Like a regime which is close to falling down, they can actually do stuff that are too much for the population because they don't have alternative. If they are facing extinction anyway, they can exaggerate. And I think that in this case, governments in the context of the collapse of the fiat system, governments would be so scared to be, I think, more dangerous than less, because yes, they are losing money, but they are the final berserk, where your body, when you are in berserk mode and your body doesn't have to think about survival anymore, only about killing the last enemy. And that's something similar. That's together with the fact that right now the power of the state in monetary terms, thanks to the fiat collapse, and maybe in the future thanks to Bitcoin as an alternative, is going down. But the power, the ideological power of the state, I think it's an all-time high since probably Nazi rise in the 30s in Germany. Something like this last weeks with people trusting the government completely about not about what to do, but about what is happening, like complete trust in institution. It is conflicted, especially in Italy it's conflicted. But let me say that this way. It's conflicted what I will do, because I don't really trust the government. But one thing is sure, I will sell my neighbor to the government in order to, it's everybody against everybody. It's a war of everybody against everybody to push everybody under the bus of the government in order to be spared. So it's a very, very, ideologically speaking, statism is not losing power. It's actually, I think, if not, all-time high, the second to all-time high after World War II.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're going to see blood before hyper-Bitcoinization, unfortunately. I think it would be nasty. I'm not entirely convinced that this is the end of the fiat system, though. It could be the event that triggers the pin that pops the bubble. But I remember thinking so... during the last financial crisis as well, that it might be over then, because things were really out of hand then already, right? Now they've we have 5 or 10 times the problem we had back then, but I'm not entirely convinced that this cannot go on forever. I'm convinced that it cannot go on forever, but I'm not convinced that this is the actual end point. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. So, there might be negative interest rates and mandatory cash withdrawals for another 10 years, for all I know, and everyone being pissed about the government but still obeying. I don't know, maybe they can pull this off somehow, the EU and US and China. Maybe they can keep their populations controlled. Maybe people will look at China and follow their example, and like we'll have those futuristic cops everywhere taking everyone's temperature for 10 years now, and maybe we'll have a police state everywhere. I don't know where this is leading. I do think we should study it closely, and we should like keep our eyes and ears open here, because anything could happen any day now. I think all these circles are scary. Like the virus is scary, the draconian measures are scary, and whatever people would do to each other is scary too. So it's all, yeah. And we need to cooperate. People need to trust each other to a greater extent, and not just institutions or whatever.
Yeah, another trade-off, which I think is very clear, because now I'm back to Italy because my family was in Italy, so I decided to my original family to stay here because my parents are here and Mir's parents are here. So we walked into the quarantine zone. But I was in Switzerland the last 3 years. I was living in Switzerland. And in Switzerland, there is they are locked down as well. It's more reasonable than Italy. Like you can go in the park alone, so it's not as Italy. Okay. But you can buy wine if you want. But the thing is that the government is traditionally, recently a little bit less, but traditionally it's less powerful because society at small level is more powerful. So you have very few examples of the government bothering you, but a lot of example of your neighbor bothering you, which is, it's always a trade-off. I think that overall that's better. Like it's good that your neighbor has skin in the game of most of the things you discuss, like if your apartment is creating a bad smell or too hot or too cold, or your neighbor will suffer more direct externalities. So it's reasonable that they stress you out for stuff. While the government is some distant bureaucracy that usually don't have neither the information or the incentives to do things rationally, while your neighbor has the incentives and information to act at the local level. So there is, so what Krut said is very important. People fighting governments and fighting statism, they are not promoting selfishness. They are methodologically individualist, but they are not like anti-social. The real opposite. In the only way to fight statism is to promote cooperation, to promote integration of people, to promote global cooperation and
exactly.
Division of labor.
And with that comes an opposition to coercion, because we have two ways of interacting with each other. We can either do it violently or we can do it by our own choice. And that's the way I look at it. And a free market, a truly free market with sound money, will enable us to exchange stuff with each other and do stuff voluntarily with each other instead of being coerced into doing stuff like it is now with taxes and inflation and interests that has to be paid to some bank. Like this is the main thing that people will have to wrap their heads around. We have only two ways of interacting with each other, and it's violently or non-violently. And this is, so I agree totally there. The anti-statist is the most social person there is. The total private transaction between two people is the most social thing there is.
This discussion may be another case where we freedom-oriented people lost the terminological battle in the last century, because I remember Mrs. Thatcher make the other example about private and public, and she was saying something very deep. She was saying, like a grocery store, a privately owned grocery store is actually very, very public, because it's always open to serve and exchange with other people. You can always enter a grocery store or something like that. While the room of a ministry, that's in theory, that's public, but it's a very, very private thing,
secretive.
Which is completely very secretive and only allowed to certain people. You cannot enter a room in the parliament or anywhere, or let's think about courts. You cannot enter that kind of facilities and do what you want, because they are privately managed by bureaucrats or politicians, while most of the market exercises, they are actually public, like the things that we do when we discuss public blockchains versus private blockchains. So that's the other, like the other way around, right? And the similar thing is about social, and like think about socialism. Socialism, people who want more society. Actually, socialists are the people that want less society, because they want more, they want to maximize basically what there was, like Franz Oppenheimer, he was saying that he was making the same distinction as Knut, and he said there are basically economical means and political means. Economical means is when you exchange, and political means is when you take stuff from others. So in the economical means, you have basically positive sum games, because I have something, but I need something else. You have something and you need something else. We exchange and we are not just as before. We are better off. We create wealth because we increase our marginal utility. Like if I have one chicken, I eat it. If I have two chicken, I can only just eat one. So my marginal utility for chicken is flat. And if you have a bottle of wine, it's the same for you. If you have two bottles of wine, you cannot, I mean, maybe you can drink two, but it's not healthy. So when we exchange, my marginal utility goes to two and your marginal utility goes to two. So in this, we are both better off. While in the aggression, I come to you to take your chicken. Not only you are worse, okay, you will fight. And so now you will have to spend a cost of fighting, so a cost of energy and recovery and band-aids after the fight. And we will have both to spend money, not on increasing our benefits, but in basically in transferring a zero sum, a negative sum transfer of wealth. So, yeah.
Exactly. We could exchange it for Corona instead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, for the record, can I say that? Yeah. What are you drinking? You're drinking a Corona. Wow, this is awesome. So Knut is one of the few that is not intimidated, because I've seen pictures. Because I've seen pictures of supermarkets where all the the beer shelves are pretty much empty except Corona. So I don't know, know how far this conditioning has gone.
I'm doing my part to save this company. I'm doing my part to bail them out. No, but the thing about the battle with, if I can just add on to that, with the battle of the words, we seem to be losing it, because everyone I know seems to think that the US is the prime example of a free market economy we have in the world, which is totally, they fooled everyone. Because it's not really a free market economy, it's a socialist economy, because of the printing of the sound of the printing press is keeping everyone shackled to whatever. That's just a hidden tax. I mean, even Milton Friedman said that in the 70s, and people before him. This is the battle we're losing. We're losing the narrative, the battle of narratives. And they like the so-called liberals in the U.S. and the Democrats. They call Ayn Rand's writings old ideas, and like people are stuck in the economists. Like what's he called? Oh, I'm confusing it with Peter Schiff, but the Nobel Prize winner, the really annoying one. Yeah, Krugman. He was on national Swedish television the other day, and he was talking about these ideas being old and boxed in and stuff like that, and we've tried that and it didn't work. But the thing is, we haven't really tried it. He's a puppet, and they all are, and they don't listen to the box talking to you, lying to you. It's just like that Zappa song, if you heard it, I'm the Slime. If you haven't heard it, look up Frank Zappa, I'm the Slime, about television.
I will.
Yeah.
Now, let me go back to my question, because, Giacomo, don't you think this is the time now to that people, let's say a critical portion of the total society could be waking up and questioning the really fundamental legitimacy question of the legitimacy of the government, of the nation state, and of every, you know, centralized structure there is out there. I mean, do you think it's going into different directions? Because I just read today, Sachsen, you know, part of Germany, they now want people who refuse or object to the quarantine to be put locked up in a psychiatry.
Yeah. So that would have been my hope, if you asked me this question just 1 month ago. But at this point, I have to sadly admit that I think it's unlikely that that this is the beginning of some kind of awakening. Because my hope was the government is going absolutely berserk, it's going absolutely crazy. They are trying to do everything they were never allowed to do, and people will react somehow. And what I'm seeing is that people are not reacting at all, basically. And maybe it's just a not yet problem. So maybe it will happen later. So maybe I'm wrong. I hope to be wrong. But if I'm right, the problem here is that the culture was destroyed way more. I mean, it was not just government versus society. It was government propaganda destroying the base of society for so long that the culture itself is completely broken. And so people are ready to fight, but they don't really have the slightest idea about what they want to fight for or against. Like people, like most of the people I know, they were like in the first world, they were basically bored and like they wanted an apocalypse because they want to give meaning to their lives. So they were expecting an apocalypse, and if it's not the virus, it's the climate change. It's not climate change, it's something else. But they want to be part of something. They are scared. But they also feel glorious in doing something inside a collective. So there is I don't see a lot of, if there is people revolting, they are not exactly revolting against the problem. They are revolting about something completely arbitrary. It's like after 2008, you have seen some part of the people under like red-pilled about the fiat system, and some other part of the people angry but still clueless, like Occupy Wall Street. So they were seeing that something was wrong, but they were completely clueless about what. And now it's like kind of everybody is more like Occupy Wall Street. In this coronavirus crisis, like everybody is like Occupy healthcare. They don't think that the government is the problem. They think that the problem is people running in the parks or Chinese people versus European people or eating animals, or I mean, they're completely randomly searching for some scapegoat.
Yeah, over here it's the right wingers that want to take more draconic measures, and like to they want more of a lockdown, especially what they call the far right. I wouldn't call it the far right; I would call them socialists. But anyway, the Sweden Democrats, the anti-immigrant party, they want a complete lockdown and more of a police state. So it's very weird because it's all tossed around, and like the words don't mean anything anymore. It seems like there is no such thing as like liberal used to mean whatever Adam Smith cooked up in the first place. Like liberal used to mean leave each other alone. Liberal was equivalent with libertarian. Libertarian now is more like, but the words are all mixed up and nothing makes sense anymore. And I believe people don't really know what the different parties think, because the parties themselves don't even know what they think. They're just there for their careers anyway, all the politicians. So I don't really know.
That's interesting if compared with the like, you know, the Citadel meme, because you know, when I started, this is something I shared already a few days ago with ugly old ugly goat and Juan. When I was reading Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged, remember having some kind of disappointment about the ending, because I'm not spoiling, but the ending was like free-minded people insulating themselves from society, from corrupt, collapsing society. And I was back then when I was reading Ayn Rand, I was also reading the sovereign individual. And the sovereign individual is the opposite, actually. He's not insulating. He's going around the world, is checking out different governments, is making arbitrage, is connecting, is exchanging, is globalizing, while the Galtian hero is insulating, which it's economically inefficient. So I was a little bit skeptical about this image of John Galt. Right now, with this consideration about the society, I understand more this kind of first kind of approach, because it's a little bit like probably somebody could have felt at the end of the Roman Empire, when it's not just the government falling down. The Roman Empire was falling down, but the Roman Empire, with inflation especially, managed to corrupt the society completely, and so every social structure was falling down. Reason, science, logic, everything together. And so there was not just the government to take down. Everything was collapsing. And so some people started to insulate in what basically what then was the monastic movement. So more like citadel theme.
I've heard that the Roman Empire, there was no, like, from to my knowledge, there was no specific date when it collapsed, because people in small groups across Europe still believed that the Roman Empire was a thing for hundreds and hundreds of years after it basically stopped functioning. Yeah. Which is so interesting, because that is what I believe will happen with our current system. It will live on and live on and live on, and we freedom seekers, we will seek other ways, better ways, build citadels, play lightning poker, whatever we do, and put brr memes on the internet, and we will live different lives than the rest of the flocks, and they will sooner or later envy us, and more people will move to jurisdictions where you're more allowed to live your life as you want to, just as in the sovereign individual. I'm halfway through the book now. But there will be no specific point in time when, all right, it has collapsed. Collapse doesn't happen suddenly, it happens gradually. Even though from a personal perspective and objective point of view, you might see it as a very specific moment in time, but I don't think it will play out like that. I'm not entirely sure.
I tend to agree. The system will collapse, but then the system reproduced itself like a virus inside the head of most of the people. So even if the central control of the system will go down, the corrupt culture of the system will still live on for maybe this will be faster than Roman Empire. I mean, it would be everything is faster now because we have a different scale. So maybe for years and not for centuries, hopefully.
Maybe I'm stepping on some Italian toes here, Giacomo, but I believe this is what has happened to the Catholic Church. Like, many of the ideas, if not most of them or even all of them, have been debunked somehow, but the meme lives on.
Well, yeah, I kind of disagree about that. I don't know about the Italian, because I'm also Swiss citizen, so maybe.
Okay. The thing is, I view religion as the predecessor to the nation state, because it's a culture meme that is big enough for flocks to follow. And like, I believe we will have there might be a third stage, something else than the nation state, which is not Bitcoin, by the way, but something else. I'm not sure, though. It's very hard to predict the future. But
you mean
dogmatic
as a
ideas.
You mean as a transition?
I don't know.
Bitcoinization?
We are seeing, not like the EU is like the follow-up to the nation state. And the US, like, we had religions and religious leaders grouping people together in parts of the world. And then after that came the nation state, or the city state, and then the nation state. And after that, the super state, the US or the Soviet Union or the EU, which are basically the same thing. They just entities that are obviously too large to sustain themselves for longer periods of time. And these are all intersubjective hallucinations we have. They're not real. Like, this table is real. This bottle of Corona is real. My opinions are mine and they are subjective. But money, nation states, religions, and whatever else we believe collectively to be true, like the English language, for instance, we all use that because we all believe it to mean, we believe that the words that come out of our mouths are representing something to the other person. But we cannot actually 100% know that what I'm saying makes any sense now. It sounds a bit gibberishy saying this, and a bit hippie, like flower powery, but I think there's a distinction between the subjective, the objective, and the intersubjective reality. And the intersubjective reality plane is the really dangerous part. And I write about this in my new book, which is coming out very soon now. About how this is humanity's... I know Yuval Noah Harari has talked about this as well. I'm not really a fan of him, but he's got some interesting ideas about that. Our ability to lie to ourselves at scale are our biggest advantage at the same time as it is our biggest shortcoming, because it has made us able to subdue all other life forms and conquer every continent and like make us the dominant species of the world, but at the expense of the individual's freedoms, because we're locked in our minds, in these mindsets that all these ideas that make us go to war or make us pay taxes or whatever it is, that they are somehow real. And they're no more real than a dream I have at night or like something I think of when I jog. I mean, the intersubjective ideas are very fascinating to me because people tend to view them as absolute truths. And I think there's a clear distinction between what an intersubjective fantasy is because and what is not, because in hindsight you can always see that the idea was ridiculous. Like, no one believes in Zeus or Thor anymore, and no one believes that garroting was a humane way of executing people, and like, we evolve like that, memes evolve, but there's an interesting thought. I don't really know where I'm going with this or where I started, but anyway. Next question, please.
Anyway, no, I agree absolutely with 99% of what you said, actually. The mimetic part is the state is not just the configuration of military power. It is actually a meme that was created. It's also a very recent meme, like absolute power to the state is very recent. It's something starting from Machiavelli in the left, in the absolutist movement in the late 16th century, and then it became stronger with the French Revolution, because it was a very nice idea in the French Revolution that was is not the king anymore, it's you in power. Yep. So the group is not representing its himself or God, it's representing you. So how can you react against you? I mean, it's just you hurting you. So be peaceful and accept it. And then there was the World War One, that was the other incredible increase, together with the beginning of extreme fractional reserve confiscation of gold, and basically the beginning of the fiat system, and then the apotheosis of statism in the 20th century. And apparently it's not ended yet. So I agree. The only point in which I don't explicitly agree, which is also the only point of Knut's book that I, well, actually only the introduction to Knut's book that I'm not sure I agree with, is the conception of religion. Knut's conception of religion as something similar to the nation state is not anything, I mean, surprising. It's completely, I mean, it's very mainstream in a way, but I tend to give more weight to the argument that makes religion as a possible opposing force to the nation state meme in the, at least not right now, if I have to be honest, like right now, like Bergoglio is a socialist puppet, but traditionally I can see the Catholic Church and in some cases even the Orthodox Church as forces of opposition to religion in general, especially Christianity in the West, as an opposition to the government. And I could go further, there are some representation of the nation state's idea that see the nation state as a competing religion, competing against Christianity to become the prevalent religion of the West. They are copying basically the rituals, the meme instead of God. If you think about now, like in the new progressive movement, you have your original sins, which is being a human being destroying the nature. You have your sins, yeah, like
I agree totally. That it's just another religion to me. But I think we're coming from. I do see that the religious institutions and the religions could be an opposing force to the political institutions, and I think this has its basis back in when secularism started and when states became secular, because then they sort of became opposing forces. Before that, they were the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Back in Galileo's time, there was no difference between the Catholic Church and the state in Italy, for instance.
Well, no, I mean, it's not entirely true. Like the power, the military power in Galileo's time was very, very decentralized. While the let's say the intellectual authority was very centralized under Rome. But if you were not in Rome under the Pontifician state, Galileo is probably a little bit late because it's almost already in the absolute states. But if you go back to high Middle Ages, like in the 13th century, what you would see would be a man where around the man you have basically a feudatory castle with his feudal relationship, then a monastery where the monk is basically the boss, and he is the boss even against the bishop. And then you have the bishop with the secular church, and then you have the free city state, and then you have the Templar Knights, that are a religious order, but they are non-territorial. Then you have a lex mercatoria of the merchant, which is an independent law system by the merchants. And then you have basically all of these interacting in a very polycentric way. And religion was basically a strong part of that, but not really a monolithic part. It was probably more distributed.
Yeah.
Of course, I think that has a little bit to do that from the fact that Christianity was becoming very powerful and very monopolistic, especially during his apex. But it was starting as a persecuted and forbidden religion. So the beginning of Christianity, like if it's very interesting to say to read, for example, Saint Augustine, because it's like, when they were under persecution, they were all about freedom of expression because they were under persecution. And then when they started to get in power with Constantine, they started to persecute. And so you can see some kind of, at least an inner a conflict inside Christianity, I think, between between monopolism and pluralism.
Yeah. I'm happy to tell you, Giacomo, in the disclaimer that like the first part of my new book, there's something about that we cannot know. We're all chained to the arrow of time, right? So we cannot know if the ideas of the Enlightenment came to be because of a well-organized Judeo-Christian society, or if the religious ideas just held us back. You cannot know which one is true because history played out in the way it did. So the thing is, I draw a clear distinction between religion and faith. I think they are two separate things. I think faith is a personal thing, and everyone is entitled to their own whatever faith they want to, whatever they want to believe. That's totally fine with me. But I find organized religion to be a very disturbing thing. Just as I find the state to be a very disturbing thing. I mean, like large entities in general are scary because there is bound to be an amount of coercion going on in organizations that are larger than Dunbar's number. Like you cannot organize people if there's not a sort of violent meme in the background scaring people that if they don't follow this, like this is in my first book, like about burial grounds and ceremonial burial. This is when nations started to expand and when city states became larger, is when they invented the lie that there is regardless of if it's true or not, they could tell their 18-year-olds to go out in battle because there would be a better life after this one. And if you can make someone believe that, you can make them kill other people. So this is from an imperialist perspective, this is a very good tool to have, just as the coronavirus is a good tool for our evil governments to have right now.
If you think about that, it's a little bit like the opposite. Like a coronavirus is perfect also for secularist mindset, because if there is not an afterlife, then you have to keep living no matter what, and you must stay home and kill everybody else because there is only. So it's interesting. Like
not kill everybody. You have to stay alive.
Stay alive.
And killing everybody else exposes you to more risk of getting the disease yourself. Yeah. So I wouldn't recommend that. Just be a recluse and fuck off and go away. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. I agree.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Like, it's true that in order to scale an idea above the Dunbar numbers, you need powerful idea. I'm not sure you need necessarily a violent idea. The example that you made before about English language is a counter example, but we could do
good example
the same with a good example, right, of a meme that can scale beyond number numbers, but also Bitcoin or the internet
gold,
even without imposition. So I think that's
sorry if it came out wrong there, I don't mean that a violent idea is necessary. I just think that is often the case.
True.
Yeah.
Especially because I see, like, we are going a little bit off topic, but I see many religion phenomenons are very not really organized, but a little bit emergent. So I don't know. I probably have a more Lindy effect view of, probably similar to Taleb view of religions as some kind of societal expression that are probably not pathologic, but that's a more personal thing, I guess.
Yeah, I sort of agreed with Taleb when I read Skin in the Game on religion, but I sort of disagreed and I sort of agreed with parts of it. But I think all Bitcoiners should read Hitchens, Dawkins, Dennett, and Harris as well.
Oh, I did for a while.
especially Hitchens.
No, I have to catch up
listen
with
to
some
his
reading
debates.
Then. Okay. There's a long list.
Anyway, next question, Kayvon. We haven't let you. You're not speaking
it's good.
At all.
No, I love listening to you guys. Let's zoom a little bit back, because I want to connect it a little bit to the recent article that Giacomo published, A Treatise on Bitcoin and Privacy Part 2. I mean, it's a Part 1, 2. Part 1, 2. Don't be misled by red herrings. Now, would you agree that both of you, I mean, want to have your take? Would you agree we are on the precipice on something here where... sometimes I ask myself how pain resistant or how conditioned have people become in order to go into action? I mean, this is the ultimate question at the end of the day, like what needs to happen? What speed, what process needs to take place in order to make people comprehend, reflect, be inspired, think about the cause and effect and go into action. Now, do you think we are about at least a critical mass, like building up a parallel society with independent infrastructure, technological infrastructures, more open source, more self-sovereignty by going into privacy tools, buying Bitcoin, taking privacy into your own hands? Do you think this is evolving? Giacomo, maybe you want to answer first?
So I think that's happening, but not really at a societal scale. This is a little bit a continuation, actually, of what we said before. Mm. I would like to think that we are on the verge of a massive let's say, awakening, or at least rejection of the status meme. And I was very possibilistic with the idea of this kind of awakening until this crisis. Now I cannot rule it out completely, but I think I'm slowly changing my mind versus something which is more similar to a niche countercultural reaction. So my thesis was the culture of liberty is niche, but the culture of slavery supported by the fiat system is collapsing. So when the fiat system will collapse, where the niche will emerge from the niche and become mainstream. While that may be true from the sheer economic point of view, like most of the wealth of the world after the collapse of the fiat system, I think it will enter Bitcoin. That may not be as true as for culture, like using privacy stuff like that. I think that the new paradigm is so different from the current paradigm, mainstream paradigm, that probably it will not just be a switch or a fast migration, but like the example of the Roman Empire, a slow progressive decomposition of the existing one, and the slow, not necessarily explosive growth of the new one. So the price change may be explosive. So I think hyperbitcoinization will probably happen, and it will be explosive because it's an economic phenomenon where, I mean, a socialist can remain a socialist, but he will hate Bitcoin, but he will buy Bitcoin because he needs, because there is hyperinflation. Mm-hmm. But the battle of the ideas, and including the battles about privacy and general and many other cultural things around Bitcoin, that may be quite slower to become mainstream.
Yeah. About privacy, we're all sitting having this meeting over Zoom now. So, yeah. And did you see the value of the Zoom company the value of the Zoom company is $42 billion. The value of the three biggest airlines in America, Delta, American Airlines, and United, is $31 billion. And it's not because they provide us with a convenient tool. It's because they record everything. And this very conversation right now is being uploaded to a server, and we're run through an AI and a facial recognition bullshit thing that is going to bust our asses one day. And we have, us three, we have all put our asses on the line because we believe that privacy is, either we don't know what we're doing, or we believe privacy to be fucked anyway, and that there's no way out. And we have a mobile phone, so there's no way we can escape this. Or we believe that some form of semi-celebrity will help us somehow, because people will think that we know what we're talking about at some point in the future. But I think privacy is basically fucked the way it is, since because of all these tools. That must be the main reason why Zoom is so highly valued at the moment. It can't only be a good, like Skype was doing this, badly, but anyway, video conferencing is not a new thing. We are given a social security score. Another sweet, you know, Erik Wall, right? He talks a lot about the private, and he experiments with this stuff and like looks himself up in Russian databases and stuff. And we already have a social security score. Like what options you get? If you're a sex worker, for instance, and the internet knows this, you will probably not get the same search results on Airbnb as a person that is not a sex worker. And facial recognition plays a part in this, because you can have a false name, but once you upload your picture, the search filter will go on anyway. And like there are, I don't really know what to do about privacy, because I just think it's a scary thing. If we stay in Bitcoin, and if we actually do work in Bitcoin and sell our, like, if there's an actual Bitcoin economy, which is not like untouched by the other economy, by the old economy, then we're finally free. But the steps to get there will be hard. And like, we can do as many coin joins and Mimblewimble coins and whatever they call them. and we can take it. Yeah, exactly. he keeps popping up in my head after another podcast I did where someone called him a cock. But anyway, privacy is a difficult thing because I don't, like we already fell into these traps with social networks. We've already been registered. You know, just need to run the algorithm and like everyone is under control already. So like the surveillance is as bad as it's really bad right now. Like people can pinpoint anyone else's location. If you have the right tools, you can guess yourself to a 99.8% probability that a person will be at a specific spot in the next 3 months and with a 99.8% accuracy because people are predictable in the patterns they move in. And AI tools are as good as this right now, and it's really scary. So until we get a real Bitcoin economy going where we interact with Bitcoin amongst ourselves, we work only for Bitcoin. Once you go full Bitcoin, that's when you get out of that. And I'm too old for that. I'm afraid. So I will have to live in the transition period, and I don't know what to tell my kids, really.
I'm a little schizophrenic in that regard too. I mean, it's a precipice because on the one hand, I'm really concerned because if this process accelerates at a speed we can't even fathom with whatever mandatory vaccination and nanoparticle, certificates as Bill Gates' wet dream is, where are we going with this? I mean, once this point is reached, can we reverse this process or can we stop it? Or that's why my question, do we really need urgently as never before build those new infrastructures, new systems, new structures in order to make the old ones obsolete? Giacomo, I mean, where are we going with this? You know, what if they ban cash right now? They have the perfect arguments right now for banning cash. And
let me give you three possible optimistic, just to change it a bit, the very pessimistic.
Sorry about the rant.
My rant was pessimistic as well. I mean, I'm trying to now try to force myself to see the silver lining. I can come up with at least with three things. The first thing is basically that, yes, the mass culture will never switch as Bitcoiners to preemptive privacy. Like Bitcoiners are trying to be preemptively conscious about what can happen after, while people in the mainstream culture, they are not. They are completely trusting everybody until the shit is the fan eventually. And only then they realize. But the interesting thing about reactive privacy concerns that are what people are basically thinking now is that the more the government will use the privacy, the lack of privacy to do bad things, the more people will start to react. Of course, too late. So in order to, I mean, you're already fucked. But it's like, I don't know what to say. The world was set in a way where everybody was thinking that there was no risk in sharing everything. Now, there was a risk. The Bitcoin culture guys, the cypherpunk guys, they were basically foretelling the risk and trying to prepare in advance, which is very, very difficult. Most of the people will not follow us on this path, but most of the people will want to react after the damage is done, when they do have the feedback. So they are very bad at low-time preference. They cannot plan now for a future privacy problem, but they will be able to change stuff with a lot of suffering, of course, with a lot of cost and destruction and suffering, and many people will lose a lot of stuff, but then they will be more basically aware and wary after. The second silver lining, I think, is that governments are inefficient. Mass centralized central planning solutions, they lack information and they lack incentives. Yep. And that makes them corrupt, but also very, very inefficient. So it's bad that they're corrupt because they become very evil because they don't have any kind of ethical constraint anymore because they're very corrupt. But they're also very, very inefficient. So even if I can think that a company like Zoom is a big company, but is a quasi-market. I mean, there are some state distortions that makes it very powerful, like patent laws and stuff like that. But being a market entity, even if it's very big, it's inside the competition culture. I remember when people were saying Bill Gates that he was a super dominant guy, and he said some kids in a garage can actually compete with me, and everybody was laughing at him. But with Google, that kind of really happened. So there is more market superpowers are more fragile than state powers, but they're more efficient. So Zoom is probably more evil and more skilled at doing evil, but more fragile. While the nation states is probably not as well organized as a Zoom company or Google. Like I will never trust the government to do anything, including bad stuff at scale. The Italian government would be terrible into actually using facial recognition data in order to text me or punish me, because they're so inefficient that they cannot do that. And the third and last silver lining is that technology is growing, and unless we enter a very Roman Empire collapse kind of recession, technology will likely keep growing. And technology growing basically helps offensive weapons development, but also defensive weapon developments. For example, deep fakes is very interesting, because now we have facial recognition, but we can basically fuck up fake facial recognition, putting any kind of politician everywhere in the web. And we do have, of course, like geolocalization, but we can mess up a lot with things. I mean, there is technology that can prevent stuff and maybe confuse stuff even more. So we can probably have some tools to counterattack.
Vive la resistance.
Yeah.
This conversation really expanded my horizon, my consciousness, as usual. So I'm really looking forward to your next book, by the way. Book, it was already a masterpiece.
Thank you.
Your articles are awesome.
Love your work.
Thanks.
Yeah. I just wanted to have like a, what do you call it? I don't know, realistic reflection with you guys. Where are we? Where are we going with this? What is really, I know, you know, things evolve out of necessity, you know, human beings go into human action because of necessity, out of experience, but unfortunately we don't learn anything out of history. My history teacher used to say it would be too good to be true if we learned something, but I am convinced that we do learn out of history. Otherwise we wouldn't evolve, you know?
No, that's why we're having this conversation right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we cannot learn from anything but history. That's the only that's the only empirical evidence we have of anything, right?
Yeah.
And we have to learn with what parts of it are distorted and distorted by what and to what extent. But that's the only thing we have. We only have what we have. We are chained to the arrow of time.
Agree. Not a great tool. History is not a great tool, but it's the only tool. So.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
We have to make it work.
Yeah. So, yeah, that, like Darwin. Well, why the fuck does this snail look like this? Like the history is all we got. We can observe
even
stuff.
Even Darwin learned, I think, a lot of about his own mistakes. You know, because I think it was more about competition in Darwin's theory. I mean, I would just maybe generalizing. But now I think we're going more into cooperation. You know, and yeah. It's sort of a multi-spectrum evolution. So to wrap this up, any final thoughts, advice?
If you want to stay home, stay home, but fire up a BTC Pay server, start to sell goods and services with that, with Bitcoin, stack sets, try to mind your privacy. It's true that it's messed up, but there is no reason to make it even easier to the adversary to get behind you. So it's true. Always think that your privacy sucks, because it does, but still use it. Yeah. Use the tools that you can use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd just like to add that I really, really enjoyed this conversation. Just that I knew that I would. I'm a bit sorry for Kevin that has been like, I mean, me and Giacomo, we've been talking a lot, but
no, that's on purpose. Yeah. That's why it's called panel discussion.
Okay. I thought listener. It was a three-way panel, but it turned out to be a two-way panel. But I really enjoy your stuff, and I think you're doing a great deed for Bitcoin, for Bitcoiners everywhere. And keep doing what you're doing.
Really appreciate it.
You too, Giacomo. But yeah,
thanks.
All right. Have a good evening. And
you too.
Yeah. Hope to have you back soon. All right.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Bye.
Cheers. Cheers. Bye-bye.
0 fly.
All right. So thanks so much for listening, for watching, wherever you are, whatever you do. Don't forget, stay humble, stack sats. And it's really time to, you know, at least we should try to inspire our, you know, our human fellow beings, neighbors, friends, family, and try to inspire them, try to educate them as much as possible. At the end of the day, you know, it's about self-sovereignty, self-responsible decision-making processes, reflection upon everything we do, lower our time preference, you know, not about, you know, what is now, but really try to somehow assess or project or somehow feel or comprehend what's going on, everything that's going around with us, with the, you know, with the lockdown, the oppressive draconian measures, whatever you want to call them, the surveillance measures, the and really ask ourselves, because what needs to happen in order to ask, you know, ask the fundamental questions, like, does the nation state, does the government and the central banks, where do they derive their legitimacy with everything that's been perpetrated for, yeah, let's say, at least 100 years or so? So we need to understand, to really comprehend totality, the causes, and not, you know, look at the symptoms and really, you know, create fundamental new structures, infrastructures, and sow the seeds so we have really healthy roots. That's why I call it monetary root layering on Bitcoin, because the roots, the soil got to be healthy, stable, in equilibrium, and more than decentralized. It should be distributed. That's the ultimate goal, from centralized to decentralized to distributed. And we have, you know, all the monetary properties with Bitcoin that we could have ever dreamt of. You know, it's harder than gold. It's hardest and scarcest money, because gold, you know, don't let us not forget, it has a relative scarcity. It's got a storage problem. It's got a saying problem of how do you validate it? How do you transact with it? Like, electronically, you can't. How do you pay with it? You know, like, how do you settle? You know, what's the settlement speed? So, you know. And with Bitcoin, you got everything. It's portable, divisible, it's unconfiscatable, it is decentralized, it's global, it is censorship resistant, and it's, you know, you can't control it. It's a beautiful design, it's a beautiful information carrier, it's an energy carrier, and it's a medium of exchange. You know, how else are we going to, you know, to decentralize all these horrendously centralized structures, beginning with the central banking structure, with the inflation machinery that's been going on, which is nothing else than theft. You know, inflation is theft, it's legalized theft, and we should more and more become aware of that. And the problem I see is that the main problem is that most people cannot even imagine, let alone comprehend, because we all been lacking the knowledge, the wisdom, the comprehension process, the understanding process. We can't even imagine what life, existence, cooperation, interactive cooperation, society, civilization, technological innovation, evolution on every level and in every dimension you can think and imagine. Whether it be on a social level, scientific level, technological level, even spiritual level, structural level, we can't even imagine we can have such a prosperous, such an unimaginably prosperous life, not only for ourselves, but for our beloved ones, for our future generations, for our children, existing or fictitious children, or for all the children, for all humanity. And I think this is, at the end of the day, we've got to ask ourselves, why Bitcoin? And Bitcoin is in essence, it's in its fundamental essence about freedom. It's about ethos, about peace, literally, without any kitsch. You know, it's about real peace within freedom, and freedom within peace, prosperity, technological innovation by order of magnitude. We can't even imagine. Have we ever asked ourselves again, for the last 100 years, seriously, we're still burning fuels, whatever technological innovation level, but it's still combustion engines, it's still jet engines, whatever, but it's burning fuel. So we should maybe, not only electronically computer information systems, we should go into different areas of technology and really evolve, really give it a jump start. And, we have all the people, we have all the genius, creative people, we have scientists, engineers, technologists, we have entrepreneurs, investors, and we would all be blossoming and thriving. And there's no need to reduce the population, whatever Bill Gates and other, elite members, have dreamt of, and their predecessors from eugenics, organizations beginning in the early 20th century. So, the rabbit hole is really deep, but I really implore you, I really beg you, go into the rabbit hole, to the different rabbit holes, start reading, start listening, not only to my podcast, to many other podcasts, whether it be, John Valley's the articles by Gigi, Robert Breedlove, Giacomo Zucco, Knut Svanholm, Safeda Namus, with his The Bitcoin Standard. It's a classical book where about, understanding, the fundamental properties, the essence of what is money, where does it come from, why do we need money, what kind of money. So, actually it starts all with expanding the horizon and the consciousness and the intelligence of the very smallest one, the children. This is where it starts. This is why I'm so against this conventional compartmentalized schooling system. Because, of course, yeah, they grow up, make a career out of it or whatever, but it's not really accelerating or opening up their creativity, their intelligence. It's and let alone like giving them the real possibility to question the narrative, the official, the dogma, the indoctrination, all these things that are being shoved down our throat, and what's next? Are we gonna get microchipped in our ass, or a micro nanoparticle certificates under our skin? Maybe we don't even need that, probably. Maybe technology is already so advanced, we don't even need a vaccine or injection. Maybe it's already in the air. Who knows, because when we talk about nanoparticles, and the technology that is just on the surface visible, but within the military industrial complex or whatever it is, I know I'm going a little bit off the tangent here, but it's really important to sometimes zoom out, zoom in, and understand the bigger, much, much bigger picture, and understand the process, and really ask ourselves, why are we doing this? Why Bitcoin? Why do we need technological innovation? Why do we need open-minded education and creativity? Because that's the only way to go. We need to ask our own behavioral patterns, our mindset patterns, our cultural patterns, you know, just because it's a tradition doesn't mean a tradition is good. You know, the same thing with religion. Just because a religion, you know, everybody can believe in whatever, you know. So I trust in the ethos of peace, of love, of science, of technology, of, you know, of equal opportunities, of equal, you know, paths to open up and to, you know, so we can evolve, you know, not only individually, but as a community, as a family, as a society, as a civilization. It's really time. It's overdue. It's the year 2020. And with everything just think about it, with everything that's going on right now, whatever the virus is out there, sure, take it seriously. You know, maybe it's a super serious flu or whatever virus, contagious, whatever it is. Maybe we're totally being lied to, manipulated, whatever. There's so much scientific and fraud going on, you know, the scientific medical establishment, the academics, the pharmaceuticals behind it, with WHO, CDC, the foreign organizations, Fauci, you know, being on the board of Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. These are like little small details. Once you like put them together and then zoom back and really like ask ourselves, do we really need this? You know, why? What do we want? What do we wish for ourselves and for our children, for our family, for our beloved ones, for our future generations? What do we really wish? You know, why can't we start enjoying, you know, a prosperous, freedom blossoming life? You know, within ethos of love, of peace, of technological innovation, of scientific innovation, by order of magnitude. And this is why I trust, not only believe, but I trust in the power, in the essence of the, in the fundamental properties, in the fundamental future and vision of Bitcoin. And it's, you know, it's all of us that's eventually necessary for that, you know, whether it's a critical mass or the total humanity, but it needs an initiative action. It needs a human action. We all need to go into human action, reflect upon ourselves and ask ourselves, why are we doing this? What do we need to do? You know, take self-responsibility, self-sovereignty, and thrive in freedom and in joy and pleasure. That's what life is about. All right. Thank you so much for watching, for listening. Thank you so much for support. Please subscribe, follow me, whatever you do. Follow Knut Svalenholm and Giacomo Zucco on Twitter. I'm going to put those in the show notes. It would do me a favor if you write a positive review or, you know, reshare it, retweet it with your friends, neighbors, family, whatever you do. But get the information out there. We all need to give. And the more we give, the more we love and share, you know, from within our intelligence, our comprehension, our knowledge, the more we receive back. And I think this is the infinity loop that we can and we should accelerate, speed up the process of evolution in every dimension we can imagine. All right. My name is Keivan Avani. The host of the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show and the Total Connector Show. Thank you so much and have a good evening and stay healthy and stay safe.